I remember, too, a ladybird took off in fright at my approach, and then there was a blinding pain, and a flash as if of colored lightning, and all went black. I do not know how long I lay a crumpled inert mass beneath the branches of the old fir tree, but quite suddenly I became aware that I was disengaging myself from the physical body. I was seeing things with a greater perception than ever before. Colors were new and startlingly vivid. Gingerly I got to my feet, and looked about me. To my horrified amazement I found that my body was lying prone upon the ground. There was no blood to be seen, but certainly there was evidence of a nasty bump just over the right temple. I was more than a little disconcerted, because the body was breathing stertorously and showing signs of considerable distress. Death, I thought, I have died, now I shall never get back. I saw a thin smoky cord ascending from the body, from the head of the body to me. There was no movement in the cord, no pulsation, and I felt sickening panic. I wondered what I should do. I seemed to be rooted to the spot in fear, or perhaps for some other reason. Then a sudden movement, the only movement in this strange world of mine, attracted my eye, and I nearly screamed, or should have screamed if I had had a voice. Approaching me across the grass was the figure of a Tibetan Lama dressed in the saffron robe of the high order. His feet were several inches from the ground, and yet he was coming to me steadily. I looked at him with utter stupefaction. He came towards me, stretching out his hand, and smiled. He said, "You have nothing to fear. There is nothing here to worry you at all." I had the impression that his words were in a different tongue from mine, Tibetan maybe, but I understood it, and yet I had heard no sound. There was no sound at all. I could not even hear the sound of the birds, or the whistling of the wind in the trees. "Yes," he said, divining my thoughts, "we do not use speech, but telepathy. I am speaking to you by telepathy." Together we looked at each other, and then at the body lying on the ground between us. The Tibetan looked up at me again, and smiled, and said, "You are surprised at my presence? I am here because I was drawn to you. I have left my body at this particular instant and I was drawn to you because your own particular life vibrations are a fundamental harmonic of one for whom I act. So I have come because I want your body for one who has to continue life in the Western world, for he has a task to do which brooks no interference." I looked at him aghast. The man was mad saying that he wanted my body. So did I, it was my body. I wasn't having anyone take off my property like that. I had been shaken out of the physical vehicle against my wish, and I was going back. But the Tibetan obviously got my thoughts again. He said, "What have you to look forward to? Unemployment, illness, unhappiness, a mediocre life in mediocre surroundings, and then in the not too distant future death and the start all over again. Have you achieved anything in life? Have you done anything to be proud of? Think it over." I did think it over. I thought of the past, of the frustrations, the misunderstandings, the unhappiness. He broke in on me, "Would you like the satisfaction of knowing that your karma had been wiped away, that you had materially contributed towards a job of the utmost benefit to mankind?" I said, "Well, I don't know about that, mankind hasn't been too good to me. Why should I bother?" He said, "No, on this earth you are blinded to the true reality. You do not know what you are saying, but with the passage of time, and in a different sphere, you will become aware of the opportunities you have missed. I want your body for another." I said, "Well, what am I going to do about it? I can't wander about as a ghost all the time, and we can't both have the same body." You see, I took all this absolutely literally. There was something compelling about the man, something absolutely genuine. I didn't question for one moment that he could take my body and let me go off somewhere else, but I wanted more information, I wanted to know what I was doing. He smiled at me, and said, reassuringly, "You, my friend, shall have your reward, you shall escape your karma, you shall go to a different sphere of activity, and you shall have your sins erased because of what you are doing. But your body cannot be taken unless you are willing." I really did not like the idea at all. I had had my body some 40 years, and I was quite attached to it. I didn't like the idea of anyone else taking my body and walking off with it. Besides, what would my wife say, living with a strange man and knowing nothing about it. He looked at me again, and he said, "Have you no thought for humanity? Are you not willing to do something to redeem your own mistakes, to put some purpose to your own mediocre life? You will be the gainer. The one for whom I act will take over this hard life of yours." I looked about me. I looked at the body between us, and I thought, well, what does it matter? It's been a hard life. I'm well out of it. So I said, all right, let me see what sort of place I will go to, and if I like it, I'll say yes. Instantly I had a glorious vision, a vision so glorious that no words could describe it. I was well satisfied, and I said I would be willing, very willing, to have my release and go as soon as possible. The old lama chuckled and said, "We had to tell him that it was not that quick, that you would have to come and see for yourself before you made a final decision. After all, it was a happy release for him, hardship for you." I looked at them both. "Very well," I finally remarked, "I will come back in a month. If you then have a beard, and if you then are sure beyond all doubt that you want to go through with this, I will release you and send you off on your own journey." He sighed with satisfaction, and a beatific expression stole over his face as he slowly withdrew into the physical body. The old lama and I rose up, and returned to Tibet. The sun was shining from a blue cloudless sky. Beside me, as I returned to my physical body, the empty shell of the old lama slumped lifeless to the floor. He, I reflected, had gone to peace after a long and honorable life. I, by the holy tooth of Buddha, what had I let myself in for? Messengers went forth into the high mountain lands to the new home carrying my written affirmation that I would do the task as requested. Messengers came to me, bringing me as a graceful gesture of friendship some of those Indian cakes which had so often been my weakness when I was at the Chakpori. To all intents I was a prisoner in my mountain home. My request that I be permitted to steal down, even in disguise, for a last visit to my beloved Chakpori was denied me. "You may fall victim to the invaders, my brother," they told me, "for they are remarkably quick to pull the trigger if they have any suspicion." "You are sick, Reverend Abbot," said another. "Should you descend the mountainside, your health may not permit you to return. If your silver cord be severed, then the task will not be accomplished." The task. It was so amazing to me that there was a task at all. To see the human aura was to me as simple as for a man with perfect sight to see a person standing a few feet away from him. I mused upon the difference between East and West, thinking how easy it would be to convince a Westerner of a new labor-saving food, and how easy it would be to convince an Easterner of something new in the realms of the mind. Time slipped by. I rested extensively, more extensively than ever in my life before. Then, shortly before the month was up, shortly before I was to return to England, I had an urgent call to visit again the land of the golden light. Seated in front of all those high personages, I had the somewhat irreverent thought that this was like a briefing during the war days. My thought was caught by the others, and one of them smiled and said, "Yes, it is a briefing. And the enemy? The power of evil which would stop our task from being accomplished." "You will meet much opposition and very much calumny," said one. "Your metaphysical powers will not be altered or lost in any way during the changeover," said another. "This is your last incarnation," said my beloved guide. The Lama Minya dawned up. "When you have finished this life you are taking over, you will then return home, to us." How like my guide, I thought, to end on a happy note. They went on to tell me what was going to happen. 3 astral traveling lamas would accompany me to England and would do the actual operation of severing one free from his silver cord, and attaching the other, me. The difficulty was that my own body, still in Tibet, had to remain connected as I wanted my own flesh molecules to be eventually transferred. So, I returned to the world and together with 3 companions journeyed to England in the astral state. The man was waiting. "I am determined to go through with it," he said. One of the lamas with me turned to the man and said, "You must allow yourself to fall violently by that tree as you did when we first approached you. You must have a severe shake, for your cord is very securely attached." The man pulled himself a few feet off the ground and then let go, falling to the earth with a satisfying thud. For a moment it seemed as if time itself stood still. A car which had been speeding along halted on the instant. A bird in full flight suddenly stopped motionless, and stayed in the air. A horse-drawing van paused with 2 feet upraised and did not fall. Then, motion came back into our perception. The car jumped into motion, doing about 35 miles an hour. The horse started to trot, and the bird hovering above flashed into full flight. Leaves rustled and twisted and the grass rippled into little waves as the wind swept across it. Opposite, at the local cottage hospital, an ambulance rolled to a stop. 2 attendants alighted, walked round to the back, and pulled out a stretcher upon which was an old woman. Leisurely the men maneuvered into position and carried her into the hospital. "Ah," said the man, "she is going to the hospital, I am going to freedom." He looked up the road, down the road, and then said, "My wife, she knows all about this. I explained it to her and she agrees." He glanced at the house and pointed. "That's her room, yours is the. Now I'm more than ready." One of the lamas grasped the astral form of the man and slid a hand along the silver cord. He seemed to be tying it as one ties the umbilical cord of a baby after its birth. "Ready," said one of the priests. The man, freed of his connecting cord, floated away in company with the priest who was assisting him. I felt a searing pain, an utter agony which I never want to feel again, and then the senior lama said, "Lobsang, can you enter that body? We will help you." The world went black. There was an utterly clammy feeling of black redness. A sensation of suffocating. I felt that I was being constricted, constrained in something too small for me. I probed about inside the body, feeling like a blind pilot in a very complicated aeroplane, wondering how to make this body work. What if I fail now? I thought miserably to myself. Desperately I fiddled and fumbled. At last I saw flickers of red, then some green. Reassured, I intensified my efforts, and then it was like a blind being drawn aside. I could see. My sight was precisely the same as before. I could see the auras of people on the road. But I could not move. The 2 lamas stood beside me. From now on, as I was to find, I could always see astral figures as well as physical figures. I could also keep even more in touch with my companions in Tibet. A consolation prize, I often told myself, for being compelled to remain in the West at all. The 2 lamas were looking concernedly at my rigidity, at my inability to move. Desperately I strained and strained, blaming myself bitterly for not having tried to find out and master any difference between an Eastern body and a Western. "Lobsang, your fingers are twitching," called out one of the lamas. Urgently I explored and experimented. A faulty movement brought temporary blindness. With the help of the lamas I vacated the body again, studied it, and carefully re-entered. This time it was more successful. I could see, could move an arm, a leg. With immense effort I rose to my knees, wavered and tottered, and fell prone again. As if I were lifting the whole weight of the world I rose shakily to my feet. From the house came a woman running, saying, "Oh, what have you done now? You should come in and lie down." She looked at me and a startled expression came upon her face, and for a moment I thought she was going to scream in hysteria. She controlled herself, and put an arm round my shoulders and helped me across the grass, over a little gravel path, up one stone step, and through a wooden doorway and into a small hallway. From thence it was difficult indeed, for there were many stairs to climb and I was as yet very uncertain and clumsy in my movements. The house really consisted of 2 flats and the one which I was to occupy was the upper. It seemed so strange, entering an English home in this manner, climbing up the somewhat steep stairs, hanging on to the rail to prevent myself from falling over backwards. My limbs felt rubbery, as if I lacked full control over them, as indeed was the case, for to gain complete mastery of this strange new body took some days. The 2 lamas hovered round, showing considerable concern, but of course there was nothing they could do. Soon they left me, promising to return in the small hours of the night. Slowly I entered the bedroom which was mine, stumbling like a sleepwalker, jerking like a mechanical man. Gratefully I toppled over onto the bed. At least, I consoled myself, I cannot fall down now. My windows looked out onto both the front and the back of the house. By turning my head to the right, I could gaze across the small front garden, onto the road, across to the small cottage hospital, a sight which I did not find comforting in my present state. At the other side of the room was the window through which, by turning my head to the left, I could see the length of the larger garden. It was unkempt, coarse grass growing in clumps as in a meadow. Bushes divided the garden of one house from the next. At the end of the grassy stretch there was a fringe of straggly trees and a wire fence. Beyond I could see the outlines of farm buildings and a herd of cows grazing nearby. Outside my windows I could hear voices, but they were such English voices that I found it almost impossible to understand what was being said. The English I had heard previously had been mostly American and Canadian, and here the strangely accented syllables of one of the old-school Thai brigade baffled me. My own speech was difficult, I found. When I tried to speak I produced just a hollow croak. My vocal cords seemed thick, strange. I learned to speak slowly, and to visualize what I was going to say first. I tended to say cha instead of jay, making chin for John, and similar errors. Sometimes I could hardly understand what I was saying myself. That night the astral traveling lamas came again and cheered away my depression by telling me that now I should find astral traveling even easier. They told me, too, of my lonely Tibetan body safely stored in a stone coffin, under the unceasing care of three monks. Research into old literature, they told me, showed that it would be easy to let me have my own body, but that the complete transfer would take a little time. For 3 days I stayed in my room, resting, practicing movements, and becoming accustomed to the changed life. On the evening of the third day I walked shakily into the garden, under cover of darkness. Now, I found, I was beginning to master the body, although there were unaccountable moments when an arm or a leg would fail to respond to my commands. The next morning the woman who was now known as my wife said, "You will have to go to the labor exchange today to see if they have any job for you yet." Labor exchange? For some time it conveyed nothing to me, until she used the term Ministry of Labor. Then it dawned on me. I had never been to such a place and had no idea of how to behave or what to do there. I knew, from the conversation, that it was some place near Hampton Court, but the name was Milsey. For some reason which I did not then comprehend, I was not entitled to claim any unemployment benefit. Later I found that if a person left his employment voluntarily, no matter how unpleasant or unreasonable that employment, he was not entitled to claim benefit, not even if he had paid into the fund for 20 years. Labor exchange. I said, "Help me get the bicycle, and I will go." Together we walked down the stairs, turned left to the garage now stuffed with old furniture, and there was the bicycle, an instrument of torture which I had used only once before, in Chongqing, where I had gone flying down the hill before I could find the brakes. Gingerly I got on the contraption and wobbled off along the road towards the railway bridge, turning left at the forked road. A man waved cheerily, and waving back, I almost fell off. "You don't look at all well," he called. "Go carefully." On I pedaled, getting strange pains in the leg. On, and turned right, as previously instructed, into the wide road to Hampton Court. As I rode along, my legs suddenly failed to obey my commands, and I just managed to freewheel across the road to tumble in a heap, with the bicycle on top of me, on a stretch of grass beside the road. For a moment I lay there, badly shaken. Then a woman who had been doing something to her mats outside her front door came storming down the path, yelling, "You ought to be ashamed of yourself, drunk at this time of the day. I saw you. I've a mind to ring up the police." She scowled at me, then turned and dashed back to her house, picked up the mats and slammed the door behind her. "How little she knows," I thought. "How little she knows." For perhaps 20 minutes I lay there, recovering. People came to their doors and stared out. People came to their windows and peered from behind curtains. Two women came to the end of their gardens and discussed me in loud, raucous voices. Nowhere did I detect the slightest thought that I might be ill or in need of attention. At last, with immense effort, I staggered to my feet, mounted the bicycle, and rode off in the direction of Hampton Court. Chapter 9. The exchange was a dismal house in a side street. I rode up, dismounted, and started to walk in the entrance. "Want your bike stolen?" asked a voice behind me. I turned to the speaker. "Surely the unemployed do not steal from each other?" I asked. "You must be new around here. Put a lock and chain round the bike or you will have to walk home." With that the speaker shrugged his shoulders and went into the building. I turned back and looked in the saddlebag of the machine. Yes, there was a lock and chain. I was just going to put the chain round the wheel as I had seen others do when a horrid thought struck me: where was the key? I fumbled in those unfamiliar pockets and brought out a bunch of keys. Trying one after the other, I eventually found the correct one. I walked up the path and into the house. Cardboard signs with black inked arrows pointed the way. I turned right and entered a room where there were a lot of hard wooden chairs packed tightly together. "Hello, Professor," said a voice. "Come and sit by me and wait your turn." I moved to the speaker and pushed my way to a chair beside him. "You look different this morning," he continued. "What have you been doing to yourself?" I let him do the talking, picking up stray bits of information. The clerk called names, and men went up to his desk and sat before him. A name was called which seemed vaguely familiar. "Someone I know?" I wondered. No one moved. The name was called again. "Go on, that's you," said my new friend. I rose and walked to the desk and sat down as I had seen the others do. "What's the matter with you this morning?" asked the clerk. "I saw you come in, then I lost sight of you and thought you had gone home." He looked at me carefully. "You look different this morning, somehow. Can't be hairstyle, because you haven't any hair." Then he straightened up and said, "No, nothing for you, I'm afraid. Better luck next time." "Next, please." I walked out, feeling despondent, and cycled back to Hampton Court. There I bought a newspaper, and continued on to the banks of the Thames. This was a beauty spot, a place where Londoners came for a holiday. I sat down on a grassy bank, with my back to a tree, and read the situation's vacant columns in the paper. "You'll never get a job through the exchange," said a voice, and a man came off the path and plonked down on the grass beside me. Plucking a long-stemmed grass, he chewed it reflectively, rolling it from side to side of his mouth. "They don't pay you any dole, see? So they don't get you fixed up either. They gives the jobs to them as what they has to pay. Then they save money, see? If they get you a job, they have to keep somebody else on the dole and the government makes a fuss, see?" I thought it over. It made sense to me, even if the man's grammar almost made my head swim. "Well, what would you do?" I asked. "Me? Blimey, I don't want no job, I just goes to get the dole, it keeps me, that and a bit I makes on the side, like." "Well, Gov, if you really want a job, go to one of them bureaus, here, let's have a look." He reached over and took my paper, leaving me to wonder blankly what a bureau could be. What a lot there was to learn, I thought. How ignorant I was of everything to do with the Western world. Licking his fingers, and mumbling the letters of the alphabet to himself, the man fumbled through the pages. "Here ya," he exclaimed triumphantly. "Employment bureaus, here, take a look at it yourself." Quickly I scanned the column so clearly indicated by his very dirty thumb mark. "Employment bureaus, employment agencies, jobs. But this is for women," I said disgustedly. "Gone," he replied, "you can't read, it says they're men and women. Now you go along and see them and don't take no old buck from them. Oh, they'll play you up and string you along if you let them. Tell them you want a job, or else." That afternoon I hurried off to the heart of London, climbing the dingy stairs to a ramshackle office in a back street of Soho. A painted woman with artificially blonde hair and scarlet talons of nails was sitting at a metal desk in a room so small it might once have been a cupboard. "I want a job," I said. She leaned back and surveyed me coolly. Yawning widely, she displayed a mouthful of decayed teeth and a furred tongue. "Oh yeah?" she said. I gaped at her blankly. "Oh yeah?" she repeated. "I am sorry," I said, "but I do not understand your question." "Oh, God," She sighed wearily. "I don't speak no English. Erfu perform." She threw a questionnaire at me, removed her pen, clock, a book and her handbag, and disappeared into some back room. I sat down and struggled with the questions. At long last she reappeared and jerked her thumb in the direction from whence she had come. "Get in there," she commanded. I rose from my seat and stumbled into a little larger room. A man was sitting at a battered desk untidily littered with papers. He was chewing on the butt of a cheap and stinking cigar, a stained trilby hat was perched on the back of his head. He motioned for me to sit in front of him. "Got your registration money?" he asked. I reached in my pocket and produced the sum stated on the form. The man took it from me, counted it twice, and put it in his pocket. "Where you been waiting?" he asked. "In the outer office," I replied innocently. To my consternation he broke out into great guffaws of laughter. "Haw! Haw! Haw!" he roared. I said, "Where you been waiting?" "And he says in th outer office." Wiping his streaming eyes, he controlled himself with a visible effort, and said, "Look, cock, you ain't alpha comic, but I ain't got no time to waste. Ave you been a waiter or ain't ya?" "No," I replied. "I want employment in any of these lines." Giving him a whole list of things I could do. "Now, can you help or can you not?" He frowned as he looked at the list. "Well, I'd know," he said doubtfully. "You speak like a duck. Look, we'll see what we can do. Come in a week today." With that, he relit his now extinguished cigar, parked his feet on the desk as he picked up a racing paper and started to read. I made my disillusioned way out, past the painted woman who greeted my departure with a haughty stare and a sniff, down the creaking stairs and into the dismal street. Not far away there was another agency, and to it I made my way. My heart sank at the sight of the entrance. A side door, bare wooden stairs, and dirty walls with the paint peeling off. Upstairs, on the second floor, I opened a door marked enter. Inside was one large room, extending the width of the building. Rickety tables stood about and at each one sat a man or a woman with a pile of index cards in front. "Yes? What can I do for you?" asked a voice at my side. Turning I saw a woman who might have been 70, although she looked older. Without waiting for me to say anything, she handed me a questionnaire with the request that I complete it and hand it to the girl at the desk. I soon filled in all the numerous and very personal details and then took it to the girl as directed. Without a glance at it she said, "You may pay me your registration fee now." I did so thinking that they had an easy way of making money. She counted the money carefully, passed it through a hatch to another woman who also counted it, then I was given a receipt. The girl stood up and called, "Is anyone free?" A man at a desk in the far distance lethargically waved a hand. The girl turned to me and said, "That gentleman over there will see you." I walked over to him, threading my way between desks. For some time he took no notice of me but went on writing, then he held out his hand. I took it, and shook it, but he snatched it away crossly, saying irritably, "No, no. I want to see your receipt, you know." Scrutinizing it carefully, he turned it over, and examined the blank side. Rereading the front side, he apparently decided that it was genuine after all, for he said, "Will you take a chair?" To my amazement he took a fresh form, and asked me the answers to all the questions which I had just written. Dropping my completed form in the waste paper basket, and his inner drawer, he said, "Come to me in a week's time and we will see what we can do." He resumed his writing, writing which I could see was a personal letter to some woman. "Hey," I said loudly, "I want attention now. My dear fellow," he expostulated, "we simply cannot do things so hurriedly, we must have system, you know, system." "Well," I said, "I want a job now, or my money back." "Dear, dear," he sighed. "How perfectly ghastly." With a quick glance at my determined face, he sighed again, and began pulling out drawer after drawer, as if stalling for time while he thought what to do next. One drawer he pulled too far. There was a crash and all sorts of personal belongings scattered on the floor. A box of some 1,000 paper clips spilled open. We scrabbled about on the floor, picking up things and tossing them on the desk. At last everything was picked up and swept into the drawer. That blasted drawer, he said resignedly, always slipping out of place like that, the other Wallers are used to it.